Welcome to Media Shift Podcast, episode 265, your guide to the digital media revolution. I'm Mark Glazer. We have some sad news to tell you about our Media Shift Podcast, as this will be the last one we produce. Media Shift will be changing its focus, and you'll hear more about that on Monday at the website. We appreciate all our loyal fans out there, and your dedication to our community, making a difference in an ever-changing media world. But before we sign off, let's get to our last podcast. In the news this week, a mass shooting at YouTube was motivated by filtering and demonetizing videos about veganism and workouts. The video service was already dealing with disgruntled creators over filtering, and now a shooting makes the situation even more fraught. Facebook tries to stem the tide of negative news by providing more context to news stories shared on the platform, including Wikipedia entries. Mark Zuckerberg will testify before Congress next week. And 3/4 of Americans believe the mainstream media runs fake news, either with inaccurate or biased reporting. And I'll go one-on-one with Jen Sabella at news startup Block City Chicago, which raised more than $180,000 on Kickstarter, will be part of the new civil blockchain journalism crew. All on this week's Media Shift Podcast. Want to keep your readers engaged? Check out our upcoming free online panel, How to Get Better Engagement Metrics. We'll have folks from the Dallas Morning News and Where By Us, and our own MetroShift editor, Jason Alcorn, will moderate. The panel is sponsored by Content Insights. You can register now to save your spot at bit.ly/engagepanel. That's bit.ly/engagepanel. Now for the big news in digital media this week. First up, YouTube mass shooter was upset with filtering policies. While YouTube has been furiously trying to filter its videos to deal with a rise in conspiracy theories and hate speech, ironically, its filtering seems to have led to a mass shooter coming to its headquarters. And the shooter was an Iranian refugee woman, Nasim Aghdam, who was upset that her vegan activist and workout videos were age-limited and demonetized, and called YouTube a dictator in her protests. On Tuesday, the 38-year-old Aghdam went to YouTube and shot and injured 3 people before killing herself. Mountain View police came in contact with the shooter a day earlier after her father filed a missing persons report. In a statement, the police department said Aghdam made no mention of YouTube or indicated her plans to harm herself or others. Aghdam's brother told CNN affiliate KGTV he warned the police department his sister might do something at YouTube because she was upset with the company. There are many strange twists and turns to the story. As the New Yorker's Nathan Heller pointed out, YouTube couldn't even cover its own story as it unfolded as the campus was on lockdown. Also, in the midst of the shooting, the Twitter account of YouTube product manager Vadim Lavrusik was hacked and started posting false information related to the shooting. After it was flagged by reporters, Twitter removed the false tweets. And as per usual during breaking news, a flood of misinformation came onto Twitter, tracked by a BuzzFeed reporter, Jane Litvinenko, who was eventually named as the shooter herself by one Twitter troll. The shooting happened right in the heart of misinformation and conspiracy theories and was itself a victim of the same problem. Next up, Facebook tries to turn the tide against it. Facebook has had a rough couple weeks. While the company is trying its hardest to turn the tide, there are still fires to be put out. Earlier this week, a BuzzFeed report unearthed a June 2016 memo by Facebook VP Andrew Boz Bosworth that defended the company's data collection practices. In it, Bosworth wrote that maybe someone dies in a terrorist attack coordinated on our tools. But he justifies this further down in the memo, saying connecting people is a de facto good. The memo, titled The Ugly, shows that Facebook does understand the physical and social risks the platform's products carry. After BuzzFeed broke the story, both Mark Zuckerberg and Bosworth made public statements distancing themselves from the memo. One of the moves Facebook has made recently to address misinformation is a new plan to show users more content about articles posted to the platform, including the publisher's Wikipedia page. The contextual information will also include related articles and a look at how the story has been shared across Facebook. Also, Mark Zuckerberg will be testifying before Congress next week to answer questions about the Cambridge Analytica data scandal. The social giant now says the rogue firm had access to data of 87 million users instead of the 50 million initially reported. Zuckerberg has been on an apology tour of media, and on the latest episode of the Ezra Klein Show podcast, the Facebook honcho said it will likely take years to solve its issues. Zuckerberg said that as the internet gets to a broader scale and some of these services reach a bigger scale than anything has before, we're constantly confronted with new challenges. This time, the challenge is right at the core of Facebook's business, targeted advertising. Whether Facebook can come up with a way to safeguard data, stop the flow of misinformation, but still continue to bring in billions in ad revenue is a critical question for the future of the company. Finally, more than 75% of Americans believe mainstream media publishes fake news. Last week, Deadspin released a video, which later went viral, showing anchors from local news stations owned by Sinclair reading a statement about one-sided news stories. And while Sinclair may be trying to inoculate themselves against accusations of bias, more than three-quarters of the American public believe mainstream news outlets engage in purposely reporting fake news, according to a new Monmouth University poll. The poll found that 65% of people believe fake news includes editorial decisions as well as inaccurate reporting. The belief that mainstream media reports fake news is up among all ideological groups. About 40% of the public say the reason news media publish fake news is to push an agenda. In addition, 8 in 10 believe outside groups are trying to plant stories in mainstream media. 9 out of 10 say the same is happening on social media platforms. Patrick Murray of the Monmouth University Polling Institute said that these findings are troubling no matter how you define fake news. Confidence in an independent fourth estate is a cornerstone of a healthy democracy. Ours appears to be headed for the intensive care unit. Of course, we can't talk about fake news without speaking about President Trump. Monmouth also surveyed Americans about the president's relationship with the media. Roughly half say that both the president and the media have been hurt by it. When asked who they trust more, Trump or the media, Americans said they trusted the media, with ABC News in the lead. But the numbers change if you look only at Republican respondents, with over half trusting the president versus ABC News and other outlets. Here are the other stories we're following. CBS is trying to buy out Viacom, but its first offer was rejected for being too low. Streaming music site Spotify had a direct public offering of stock with the price down 10% on its first day, but it hit a value of nearly $27 billion. Thousands of Google workers are asking the tech giant to pull out of an artificial intelligence project for the Pentagon. And an experiment at the Bay Area News Group found that users were more willing to pay for subscriptions if they could keep their ad blockers on. We'll be back with the one-on-one interview after the break. What user metrics matter most when reader loyalty is your goal? MediaShift is convening experts from The Economist and Spirited Media for a free online panel on loyalty and revenue metrics, sponsored by Opinory, moderated by Jason Alcorn. Register now to save your spot. Go to bit.ly/loyaltymetrics. That's bit.ly/loyaltymetrics. Our special guest this week is Jen Sabella, a co-founder and director of strategy at Block Club Chicago. She was deputy editor and director of social media at DNA Info Chicago, a site she helped launch in 2012. Before that, she was HuffPost Chicago editor and a breaking news reporter at the Chicago Sun-Times. Welcome to the show, Jen.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
So Chicago has an interesting history with media and especially local news experiments. There was Every Block that started in Chicago and the Chicago News Cooperative, and then DNA Info in 2012, funded by Joe Ricketts. Why do you think Chicago has been such a breeding ground for these kinds of experiments?
I think Chicago is a great news town. Every neighborhood is its own little colony. People are very neighborhood focused here. They're very obsessed with their neighborhoods. They're very proud of their neighborhoods. And it's just a dynamic, interesting city. I mean, the politics alone make it worth covering from a news side, but also just the shrinking media landscape here. I think when I was at the Sun-Times, I watched the newsroom as it was completely cut in half. We went from having like two floors to having, you know, half of one floor. So I think these other organizations have kind of looked at Chicago because there's such a clear need for a more truly local coverage here. At least with DNA Info too, like no one, like the Chicago News Cooperative came and, you know, other outlets, but no one was really covering, you know, day-to-day neighborhood news, you know, the way DNA Info did.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit more about your experience with DNA Info. You know, it was another attempt to produce these kind of hyper-local, like you said, neighborhood coverage and journalism online. And it seemed like you had a great team there and some momentum, but it was merged with the Gothamist sites. What do you think went wrong there?
It was more like Mr. Ricketts bought the Gothamist sites. And at first we thought it was just an effort to kind of grow into other cities, because Gothamist had sites in, you know, LA and San Francisco and DC, that it was going to be, hey, maybe there's going to be a DNA Info in those cities too. And it would help. There was an ad sales business plan there. So being able to sell on a more national level, it just wasn't. And I think as like many of us who watched the media struggle with the ad model over the years, it's just not necessarily the best way to be sustainable. It's especially hard when you are only selling to like a market like Chicago. I mean, and I know DNA Info's ad staff was going after, you know, mom and pop businesses, and they just don't have a lot of money to spend on advertising.
That's true. And what do you think about now these public media stations, WNYC and KPCC and WAMU, have now taken over some of the sites recently? What did you think about when you heard that?
I was honestly really glad that someone was going to pay to keep the archives alive. It is not cheap to keep the DNA Info archives. Even we just looked into it for Chicago alone. We would publish 40 stories a day, and that's for 5 years. And I'm not great at math, but it's a lot of stories.
Yeah.
So it's extremely expensive to host. That's not even counting all of the photos, and we had huge interactives, and it's a lot of money to keep that going. So I applaud WMIC for, you know, stepping up and keeping that work alive, because I know we depend on it every day, and a lot of the city still does.
Yeah. So let's talk about your new venture, Block Club Chicago. You are one of three co-founders of the new site, and there was a blog on DNA Info called The Block Club, so I'm assuming it kind of was an outgrowth of that idea. How do you think this effort will be different than the others that came before it?
It's going to be a lot like DNA Info in terms of how we approach our coverage. We have our neighborhood-based reporters. They're going to be filing stories every day. It's more of a, you know, it's a quick pace. We do a lot of breaking news. We cover night meetings. We cover school board meetings. It's the nitty gritty day to day news of the neighborhoods. We do want to spend some time doing more investigative stuff as well, and some longer form stories. But that was never our primary focus at DNA and at Block Club. Our focus is, you know, getting people the daily news they need on a local level. So we think that there are other outlets in town doing amazing investigative work, and we hope to partner with places like ProPublica or WBEZ on that kind of work. But we're going to be doing the day-to-day, you know, boots on the ground. We're noticing the permits going up. We're listening for what the developer is saying they're building in Logan Square. So we're just doing that. You know, it's not always the sexiest stuff, but it's right. The stuff that people living in the neighborhood want to know. And I think that our huge audience at DNA proved that there was just an appetite for it. People in Chicago just really care about their neighborhoods and they feel very connected to them.
Definitely. And you had this Kickstarter campaign, which raised more than $186,000, which is the most successful journalism campaign on that platform. How did that happen? It seems like it just snowballed.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was kind of funny because when we were talking about doing this, we were like, well, you know, Kickstarter, if you don't hit your goal, you don't get to keep the money. So we were going back and forth about setting it at 50,000 or setting it at 25,000. And we ended up settling, I think, at 25,000, which was kind of comical after we saw the response, which was amazing. I mean, we knew people missed it just because every single day, like I'd get 1,000 like Facebook messages and text messages and all of our reporters just like in tweets, you know, we missed DNA info, or people would just like tag DNA info in like when things were going on. They would like take a picture and they would at DNA on Twitter or like text the neighborhood reporter like help. So we knew that the appetite was there, but I don't think we expected to make that much money. I mean, we didn't expect it at all. We hadn't even dreamed of it. Like, that's why when on day one, it became pretty clear that we were going to raise more than $100,000, we decided to, you know, well, this that's allows us to hire another reporter, which is amazing. So that was just an added bonus. We did not anticipate being able to do that. And we're in the process of doing that right now. So I'm really stoked.
Yeah. And so because of that, raising much more, you're able to basically hire more people than you had planned.
Right. And I think that the thing that resonated about our Kickstarter was we were really just putting it out there. Like, every single dollar is going to reporting. Like, that we're a nonprofit. Like, we aren't trying to get rich off of this. We want to be sustainable. So we're not going to be able to be in every neighborhood the way we were at DNA Info. We weren't in every neighborhood, but we were in a lot more. We're going to do it slowly. We're going to do it sustainably because we don't want it to fail. We believe Chicago needs this. And hopefully if we can make this work, it's, you know, an example for other cities who are trying to, you know, make hyperlocal work.
Yeah. And you said you're going the nonprofit route with the business. Have you set up the nonprofit yet? And why did you make that decision?
We currently have a fiscal sponsor. We're working with the Institute for Nonprofit News. They've been amazing. Yeah. So the 501c3 process is long. So we're, you know, I just bought like Nonprofits for Dummies. I think it's in the mail.
Yeah.
So it's like three journalists like trying to figure it out. But we have been very fortunate in that people from the foundation world and from all over the city really have reached out to us and said, you know, we really value what you're doing and we're happy to help you. So just the generosity of people in Chicago has been heartwarming and we're thrilled. But we decided to be a nonprofit because I think after DNA shut down and just like watching the media conversation and seeing what's happening with, you know, like the LA Times and just with every like local media outlet in the country, there's just this like, I guess it's always made me want to bang my head against the wall. Like, it's not like new local news is not a big money game anymore. And it's just really frustrating to kind of watch these newsrooms suffer because management thinks it's going to be, or they throw away the day-to-day local reporting to pivot to video because they're going to make all this money off video. And it's just, we wanted to make it very clear. We are in this for the mission. We are in this to bring local like journalism to Chicago's neighborhoods. And every dime that our readers give us will be invested in doing just that. So we just thought that being a nonprofit kind of communicates that. Like, this is where our agenda. Our agenda is bringing you news. I'm not going to buy a Benz. I work in journalism. I know better than that.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was kind of our mission. And also, you know, there are a lot of amazing charitable organizations in Chicago. And when DNA shut down, a lot of them reached out to us and they said, hey, like, there is money here, like, especially for covering underserved areas. There are a lot of organizations looking to help and make an impact. And they know that reporting these stories that are untold does make an impact. So we're hoping that they help us out as well.
And you've also said you're going to charge subscriptions for your content at $4.99 a month. Does that mean everything will be behind a paywall, or how are you going to work that? Are you still developing it?
We are still developing it, but no, we will not be, everything won't be behind a paywall. It'll be a metered system. So before any sort of paywall goes up, we want to make sure the metered system is working properly, because we want people to be able to access like 10 stories a month without charge, and all breaking news will stay free. It's just kind of a, you know, business decision keep us sustainable. I mean, yes, like, there are charitable organizations, but relying on that is, you know, that's, it's just not going to work. I mean, just, it's too risky. And we felt that we could depend, you know, we could plan our coverage and plan our future neighborhoods we're going to cover based on subscriptions more. So we'll have a $4.99 level, and we're going to have a higher level. I think it's going to be about $10. And then we also have a level that allows you to sponsor a membership. So if you were to pay, you know, I think we're working out all the details on this, but through the Kickstarter, we had an option where if you gave a certain amount, you get a subscription for yourself and you get to give one to a list. So we'll be collecting email addresses from people in Chicago who can't afford a subscription, and we'll let other members of the community sponsor their subscriptions. So we just want it, we want it to be accessible to everyone, but we also are being realistic about our financial needs to keep it going. So we're trying to be, you know, walk the line. I hate sites that just are automatic paywalls. Right. I don't think it's for building audience, and we definitely need to do that. So there will be, you know, if you're a very active user, you'll probably hit a paywall after 10 stories. But otherwise, if you're checking the breaking news in your neighborhood, it will be accessible.
Interesting. And so you talked about, you know, getting some grants, you know, having subscriptions. Are there other things you might see as potential for revenues? Will you do advertising at all? Or, you know, will you do events? I mean, what other ways do you think you might be able to bring in more money?
We are definitely not doing advertising. We're open to sponsorships, kind of what like the public radio model. Uh-huh. So if, you know, a business wanted to sponsor like coverage of parks or, you know, summer activities, like that would be something we would entertain. But even our platform is not going to be built to accommodate advertising. So that is just not in our model. Events definitely are something we're going to focus on. And we've realized even just before our launch, just having like small community meetups is an awesome way to get story ideas. It's a great way to engage with the neighborhood and get our readers out and meeting us face to face. And people will show up to these things and they'll kick in a few bucks. So we don't think it's going to be a cash cow, our yeah. events, but we think it'll be a combination of like, we think it'll be, you know, cheap and easy ways to engage with our audience and hopefully make some money down the line. And we're also doing swag, because I've always been a fan of like a tote bag or a t-shirt or a mug. So yeah. We have a great designer who worked at DNA with us, who has generously helped us with our logo and some other designs. So we're really excited about that. So hopefully people will want to geek out and wear their Black Club merch.
Definitely. And now Block Club Chicago is part of Civil, the blockchain journalism company. And we had their CEO, Matt Iles, was on our podcast recently. And he said that there was an initial coin offering coming pretty soon. So tell me more about just, you know, your decision to work with them and what's coming. When do you think you'll be able to launch with them?
So we're looking at a May launch with Civil.
Okay.
And that, yeah, so I'm not exactly sure on the date yet, but Civil has told us it'll be May and not late May. So we're hoping early to mid-May. And they honestly, like, we talked to a lot of different people after DNA shutdown. People came and they said, hey, how can we help? And Civil just had the best pitch for us, which was like, do whatever you want. Like, we believe you know the news, you know how to do what you do in your city. We just believe in, like, they just believe in, like, journalism, and they are very, like, passionate about that. And the fact that they're helping fund all of these different newsrooms across the country, it's just amazing. And we met, you know, everyone at Civil, and actually Nicole Bodie, she trained me at DNA Info. She was a DNA Info New York deputy editor. She joined Civil. So that was like even more of a sell for us. Like, it's people we trusted. They were totally cool with us wanting to be a nonprofit and, you know, run our business the way we want to run it. And they've given us like so many resources. We've worked with the folks over at Old Town Media, Tom and Josh and Catherine, and they have been just incredible, just like to bounce ideas off of. And they looked over our business plan. And I mean, just Civil has been, I mean, just like our guardian angels, honestly. Like, and I had no familiarity with the blockchain or cryptocurrency or anything like that when I first started hearing about Civil, and I was a little bit scared. But once I met everyone, heard them out, read more, listened to the brilliant Maria Bustillos, who is running Popula, a site based in LA, through Civil. She is just like so passionate, so dedicated to, you know, sustainable journalism that's decentralized, that there's not, you know, a big rich person like owning it. It's kind of owned by the people. And I mean, that's what we want to be about. So I think our mission is just really aligned.
Sounds like that. And so do they've given you, you know, actual funding as well as kind of tokens in their offering, or how does that work?
They've given us funding, and we've negotiated some tokens, but we're not for the business, just more for our participation early on in the process. Yeah. So we're still wrapping our heads around the tokens. So I'm always like, Matt Coolidge knows everything about tokens, and that's who we should talk to about that. Yeah. They've just been very like helpful, hands off in terms of editorial and hands on in terms of helping in any way that we ask. So yeah, I'm not sure about the token stuff yet, but hopefully every time I listen to Maria on a podcast or read an article, I'm like, I get it now. And then I need to reread some stuff. So
yeah, I think everyone has the same feeling when it comes to blockchain, that like you kind of get it, but you don't totally understand it, and you want to get it. But it is interesting just how much influence it's starting to have in the kind of journalism world, and especially with Civil.
Totally. And it's more like I trust the people involved so much, and just like some of the journalists that are on board, I think it's very clear that they have gone out of their way to like work with quality journalists and, you know, bring really smart people into the room. And I just really like notice that, and I respect that. And I feel very, you know, safe with Civil, and I'm very glad to be part of the first fleet block club.
Definitely. And so when you launch, you're going to have, I mean, are you now just already just starting to do reporting, just kind of building up your story base, or are you waiting until the launch? How are you going to do that? How is the timing work for you editorially?
Yeah. So our reporters, it's kind of funny because our stories were so day to day that a lot of our reporters just like never stopped. They'll just be like walking down the street and be like, hey, this is going on. So we just left a meeting, and the woman we were meeting with was like, oh, I've been following my neighborhood reporters this whole time, like since November, since you guys shut down. And I just continue to stay up to date because they just never stopped working. So we have a Medium that we will publish a few things on, and then our reporters will just like tweet out day-to-day stuff. But we just had a story meeting last week, and we have a few bigger stories we're working on for launch. So yeah, we're excited about some longer term pieces, and we're excited to give the reporters a chance to like dig in a little bit, since when we were live at DNA, it was hard for them to do that with just the daily grind. So we should have some good stories out the gate.
And I saw that the Chicago Tribune columnist, Heidi Stevens, she wrote a piece about Block Club and basically welcomed you back to the reporting beat. I mean, how does that feel getting a note like that from a competitor, you know, to basically say like, hey, we want you back in the game?
I think it's, first of all, I love Heidi and she's a friend and has been very kind to us. When we got shut down, she kind of rallied the troops to buy us drinks and raised more than $3,000 from people all around the country who offered to buy us, you know, layoff drinks. So she's an angel.
That's a lot of drinks.
I know, right? I mean, you'd be surprised. We're Chicago journalists. We can put them back. But yeah, like the response after we shut down from the media community at large was like, oh shit. Hopefully I could say that on your podcast. But they relied on us so much. Like the TV stations alone, they were like, you guys, without you guys, we do not know what to do. Like we, every day, the first thing we did was check DNA info. We were like the tip sheet for all the TV news stations in town. And I think we, the stories that we surfaced on a neighborhood level led to a lot of bigger pieces in the Tribune, the Sun Times, WBEZ. I think every journalist in town would acknowledge that they relied on DNA info pretty heavily just for story ideas. And they just relied on it for coverage of their neighborhood. I think that we're all in this together in terms of the media world, specifically in Chicago. And you never know who you're going to be working for. You never know who you're going to be working with. So we all try to have each other's backs. Not every day. And some people are haters. But for the most part, you know, we're a community. Exactly. We like to support each other. So it's been really nice. Everyone has been super cool. And a lot of other journalists show up to our like meetups and, you know, wish us well. And a lot of them gave to the Kickstarter. So it was really cool.
Well, I will see. I hope that if you can make this thing work, that maybe, you know, other cities will kind of follow your lead and take a similar, you know, similar revenue and nonprofit tactic.
I mean, that's the dream. It's like, I just think it's so important, you know, in every city to have something like this. And if nobody's covering these meetings, like, Lord knows what people in power are getting away with just because the media, local media, yeah, has been decimated. So, yeah, that's the goal, is to keep people accountable and keep covering local news. So hopefully it works. I'm optimistic.
Yeah, me too. Well, Jen Sabella, Block Club Chicago, thanks so much for joining our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Thanks for joining us for the very last MediaShift podcast. A big shout out to our special guest, Jen Sabella, our producer, Jefferson Yen, and associate editor, Bianca Fortis. We also want to thank our fantastic MediaShift community of fans and listeners for supporting us over the years. Our podcast is signing off for now, but stay posted on mediashift.org for great things to come.